You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 1st, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist David Dayan on his piece in the American Prospect, Bring Back Antitrust. Also on the program today, Ted Cruz making his move. Meanwhile, release memo shows Clinton pushing Obama to close Gitmo back in 2012. Retired Special Forces head, ISIS exists because we went to Iraq. And reports from COP21, the Paris climate talks. Protesters are quashed dramatically. A lot of house arrests. Pre-crime, really, in Paris. We'll get a roundup of the way that environmentalists are looking at the talks at the moment. Meanwhile, this just in, the police chief in Chicago has been fired by Rahm Emanuel as he looks for scapegoats for what appears to be massive corruption in the Chicago police force in terms of, well, not just the Laquan McDonald case, frankly. I mean, they had a black site there, for God's sakes. And pressure works. Andrew Cuomo reportedly prepared to reduce the implications of student test scores in teacher evaluations. And the conservative YouTube star apparently renounces conservatism. It's amazing that I can actually say the words conservative YouTube star and the way they rally around these guys. And also, Sheldon Silver, the former leader of the Senate in New York State. I should start off by telling you folks something you probably already know. I've had a cold, and I continue to feel the effects of that cold and also manifest the effects of that cold via my voice. So by midweek, things will sound actually pretty sultry, and I'll have a proper radio voice. But right now, and then I'll go back to my normal voice. But for a couple of days, I'll have a proper radio voice. And I think people know the drill from when Myla, my first child, was Saul, my second child's age. He gets the sniffles, I get the plague. And there's about a 2 or 3 day lag time. So a couple days before Thanksgiving. He had a sniffles, and it was just tiny sniffles. Didn't look like much. And then within days, I can barely walk. So thank you to my child for that. Sheldon Silver, ladies and gentlemen, found guilty on multiple counts. I mean, the guy was just very, very dirty. But, you know, I think we mentioned this, Michael, when he was first arraigned.
Yeah.
That this is a big problem for us because he was a Cedarista.
Yeah, he was a major supporter,
major supporter of the show.
He liked to kick back and plot out some asbestos-related claim schemes and listen to... He was a big fan of Random Rush.
Excuse me, did I say he was a Senate? He's an assemblyman.
Oh, he's assemblyman.
Yes, he was the head of the House.
And he represented, I think, Lower East Side.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you have the opportunity to become a member of the program to fill that gap, that not just... it's not just Sheldon Silver. It's also the... 8 different accounts he had set up to support the program under fake names.
It was weird. I mean, we got the money, but when we looked at it, somehow it
all came from the same address.
Him. Yeah,
same address.
It was bizarre.
Yeah, very strange.
Yeah.
So with that said, you know, you can become a member at the Majority Report. Also, I want to tell you about this. It's a new book by the New York Times bestselling author Greg Olson. She's a killer who has cajoled, seduced, blackmailed, and left a trail of bodies all across Washington State. And after a daring prison, After a daring prison escape, she's finally free to carry out her ultimate act of revenge. Number one, a New York Times bestselling author, Greg Olson, brings back pathologist Bertie Waterman to try and stop a murderer as brutal, brilliant, and twisted as Brenda Nevins. You'll sleep with the lights on after reading this electrifying thriller. Now That She's Gone by Greg Olson is on sale now wherever books are sold. You can find more information online at kensingtonbooks.com or gregolson.com. Excuse me, folks. This could be a short show today.
You all right there, buddy?
Yeah, why don't you talk for a second?
I want to read this book. I did think that it was prototyped on Kelly for a second. But when was the last thriller that either of you guys read? I used to be a big John Le Carre fan. I would think you'd like him a lot, Matt.
I've been meaning to read Le Carre.
I think you'd really like him.
The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, I think. That's...
Constant Gardner.
I've seen that.
I horror and thrillers a lot, movies and TV.
Right.
But I don't know about reading one. This sounds like a good idea.
It is a good idea. This book actually sounds really good.
And it sounds like it's modeled after my life.
Quality vamping, guys.
What do you want from me?
No,
I'm looking over you. You look like you're dying. I'm like a little distracted.
Yeah.
Sam literally looks like he's having some type of slow motion cardiac arrest. All right,
you
ready?
When I woke up this morning, I was like, I think I can make it. It should be okay. And as I walked down here, I was like, oh, my God, this could be a long day.
The last time you were like this and I covered for you, I got sick, I think, just from sharing that mic.
Yeah. No, I think, and I would be doing that mic.
Done.
For a while. Folks, as you know, it is now officially, what is it? Is it now officially the Christmas shopping season?
It's the Hanukkah shopping season.
It is for me.
You.
It's the Hanukkah. It's a Hanukkah season, but it does move into the Christmas because
Shelley
I do have
Shelley Silver.
Not for Shelley Silver. but like I say, it is the holiday gift giving season, ladies and gentlemen. And I got a new Harry's razor set. I got it from Harry's, actually, but it is an awesome gift idea. And I'll be honest, it didn't occur to me like this is a great gift, but it is a great gift. This is like the perfect, I'm not going to give this obviously to my children because they don't shave, but I would give this gift to my dad for Hanukkah. Yeah. I would give this to my father-in-law as a Christmas gift. And they also do this white elephant thing where you're supposed to get gifts that are sort of like, people sometimes get gifts that are, you know, not great, but they also get gifts that are good. This is the perfect gift for that because men and women can enjoy it. Now, I've talked to you about Harry's many times. I love the shave. I love the feel of the razor. It looks like a looks a little old-timey, sort of like a chrome blade that is not, that is sort of smooth, and it's just a nice handle. This holiday season, Harry's has something for every guy. And frankly, a woman out there, whether it's Secret Santa gift for your office colleague, you know, the guy who you know is seemingly impossible for, or frankly, for yourself. Holiday shaving sets at all different price points, starting at $15. As a special offer for my listeners, Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase when you go to harrys.com and enter the promo code Majority Report. Harry's not only makes its own really great high-quality grooming products, but they also give 1% of their sales and 1% of their time back to the communities they serve. So you can feel good about a gift that gives back. Finding the perfect gift from Harry's couldn't be easier, and it's all online. It's easy to use. It takes less than 30 seconds to place an order. Go to harrys.com right now. Special offer for my fans, you get $5 off your first order with the code MAJORITYREPORT. Don't wait. Free shipping for the holidays ends on December 10th, so act now. It's harrys.com, harrys.com. Enter the code MAJORITYREPORT. Harry's makes every morning feel like a holiday.
Thanks, dude.
But then you got to go to work.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, David Dayan. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is always a pleasure to welcome to the program our next guest. David Dayan is a contributing writer at Salon, The Intercept, The Fiscal Times, The New Republic, and, I mean, you are like the king of all media, aren't you, David?
Maybe a lesser order, maybe just a lieutenant of all media.
Or what about like the crown prince of all media? How's that?
The clown prince, I
Well, please. And honestly, I mean, well, I've said this for years, but nobody writes on more topics with more depth than you, in my estimation.
Oh, I appreciate
it. And I mean that anywhere.
Right. Thank you.
I mean, I don't want to speak to what your home life must be like, but I got to think there's not much else going on.
I live in a small basement. there's nothing on the wall to distract me. And there you have it.
Well, I've asked you many times before too, like, how many do you sleep at all? And my guess is honestly, you probably do, one of those people like get 3 hours of sleep a night. But let's leave that aside for a moment, David, because I really...
More like six, if we want to get into the personal life.
Six? You know, yeah. They say you need eight.
I know, that's an Arianna Huffington thing, right?
Yes.
That's why I don't write for her.
There you go. She doesn't like your sleeping practices.
I want my sleep schedule.
All right, well, let's talk about this piece that you've written in the American Prospect, not even one of the five publications I mentioned up top.
Yet another.
This is a big piece that you've written, a deep dive into the idea of antitrust. And yep. You do mention, and it, really the only time I've heard really any talk of this, I mean, obviously the net neutrality fight was a big issue, but in the course of her campaign for governor in New York State, Zephyr Teachout did bring this up, and you mentioned that in your piece. But yep. you also start with the story of a medical device company, Retractable Technologies, which you weave throughout your piece. Just tell us the story of that and why you chose that story to weave throughout your piece.
Sure. Retractable Technologies is a company that was founded by a guy in a place called Little Elm, Texas. His name is Thomas Shaw. And in the 1980s, he was watching news reports about the AIDS crisis, and particularly this epidemic that was occurring in our nation's hospitals, known as needle stick. And needle stick occurs when a nurse or a nurse's assistant or some sort of medical technician delivers a needle, and because of the way syringes are built, there is a lot of risk that once you depress a needle into the patient and take it out, a lot of risk of accident, that you can be stuck by the needle and then you have this contaminated needle in your arm. And this was leading to a surge in the 1980s of both incidences of contraction of AIDS and contraction of hepatitis. And Thomas Shaw was an engineer, and it seemed like a solvable problem to him. So he spent years buying tons of syringes and trying to come up with a way to, you know, build a better mousetrap, build a better syringe, one that would reduce or eliminate this risk of needle stick. And he figured it out. He came up with an idea for a retractable syringe. That's why they're called Retractable Technologies. Basically, you would depress the syringe into the patient, and then it would automatically hit a ring and retract once it completed its payload of medicine or whatever you're depressing into the patient. When you pull it out, there would be no needle sitting there just waiting to be plucked into the arm of a medical technician. So this was, not only did this guy invent this thing, but he got a grant from the National Institutes of Health, hundreds of, I think millions of dollars, to market and develop and produce these syringes. There was actually a federal law that was dedicated to reducing the incidences of needle stick, which was a real epidemic at this time.
Right.
His technology would have fit perfectly. So everything was working out for Thomas Shaw up until the moment when he tried to sell the retractable syringe. And that's when he found out that about 60 to 80% of the syringe market was owned by one company, a company called Becton Dickinson, or BD. And when he would try to go into hospitals and say, look, I have this thing that's going to be better for your employees, better for safety. You know, comply with federal law. It's better for pretty much everyone. They would say, well, we buy our syringes from Becton Dickinson, and we buy them in such a way through a something called a group purchasing organization that we would take severe penalties if we didn't buy our syringes from Becton Dickinson. And Thomas Shaw has, in the two decades since coming up with this product, tried to use the antitrust laws to say that this company, BD, was monopolizing this market. They have made it inhospitable for us to be able to compete on a level playing field and sell our product, which actually works better. He has successfully won two large cases that resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars in settlements that have gone from BD to retractable technologies. And yet, today, retractable controls maybe 1% of the market. That's their market share, maybe 1%. And Becton Dickinson still controls the majority of needles sold in America today.
So from retractables standpoint, the guy's making money, but he's not doing what he wants to do is bring this solution to the hospitals, because
right.
apparently BD has a lesser quality product.
Correct. And the perfect stat to illustrate this is that when Thomas Shaw was starting out, there were about 380,000 needle sticks a year. Now, today, when we have the technology to eliminate them, there are 385,000 needle sticks a year. So the reason I use this example is that people talk about monopolies solely in terms of price, right? That when you have a monopoly, that monopoly actor can then jack up the price of a particular good because they have no competition, and if you need that product, you're going to have to pay the price. But it's not just that. That is not the only thing that monopolies affect. In this case, it's affecting the quality of life and the safety of workers. Because there's a monopoly on this particular product, medical technicians are at risk. And preventable diseases are being propagated throughout the population for no reason, only because it matters to the bottom line of Becton Dickinson, who has engaged in these monopolistic practices for decades and decades and achieved this monopoly that cannot be dislodged even after, you know, multiple lawsuits showing what they are doing.
So in the law, I want to clarify two things. One is that the lawsuits are private lawsuits.
Yes, this is not antitrust enforcement. There's a difference between using the antitrust laws as a private litigant and using them through an enforcement action through either the Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission. Both of them have overlapping responsibilities.
Okay, and then in terms of the way that BD maintains this monopoly, do they sell other products that the hospitals need at a discounted rate, or is it that how is it that they maintain this when the hospitals could get these products? Obviously the availability of the product, but what is it? How do they?
You would have to go into this group purchasing organization kind of way in which large medical device suppliers supply hospital chains. And through these GPOs, they basically give discounts to the hospital if they buy the product, but they lock them into a contract. Often there's something called the 90-10 rule in it, where if you decide that you're going to buy this product, you have to buy 90% of it the next year. And if you don't, you get hit with these huge penalties. You have to basically give back all the discounts that you ever got. So that's the way that this is generally enforced. There are other means by which it's enforced. And a lot of it is not so much a monopoly as oligopoly. I mean, what Thomas Shaw said to me is that Johnson & Johnson has the ability to make a better syringe tomorrow if they wanted to. But if they don't get into the syringe market and Becton and Dickinson doesn't get into the Band-Aid market, then everybody can sort of keep their market share in their various positions within medical devices and supplies, and everybody's happy. So that's what tends to happen in that particular sector, and this is replicated throughout the U.S. and global economy. I mean, I go through in the piece the concentration of industry that we've seen over the last several decades. And it's really remarkable that there's almost nothing that you buy on a daily basis that isn't part of some very concentrated market.
Fascinating. All right. Well, let's go back to the history of antitrust in this country, and then we'll talk about. I mean, you list a couple of examples of just how monopolized different. Different products are the idea that one company makes virtually every different brand of sunglasses in the world. Yep. And
the stores where they're sold.
Well, that was the amazing thing, too. They own Lens Crafters and Pearle Vision and Sunglass Hut. And
the company's called Luxottica. It's an Italian company.
And, I mean, everybody's familiar with the state-mandated cable monopolies, and everybody, I think, has a fairly pronounced opinion on how effective that is.
And what do they look to when people talk about how crappy their cable service is? They do talk about how it's they jack up the prices, but they also talk about the fact that you have to wait from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on an odd Thursday if you ever want service. They talk about the quality of the product.
Well, also, I mean, if you're like, for instance, if you're outside, I don't know what it's like in other parts of the country in terms of rural, but I know that in just 2 hours outside of New York City, the internet speeds are shockingly low. I mean, they're like dial-up, I mean, quality.
And what is the incentive for a Verizon or an AT&T or a Comcast when they have a virtual monopoly in that community? What is the incentive for them to deliver a better product? They're not competing.
Zero. Zero.
There's no incentive. In fact, when we see these community broadband operations in places like Chattanooga, Tennessee, they get massively faster speed.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a technology problem. This is not an issue that we have to solve with better fiber optic technology or something. It is purely because it is cost effective to people who don't have to compete for your business to deliver a worse product.
Absolutely, 100%. All right, well, let's talk about the history of it, because it was the first antitrust law that we saw in this country was the Sherman Act. Is that right?
Yeah, the Sherman Antitrust Act.
And
this followed a period, you know, we called it the Gilded Age. This followed a period of extreme concentration that largely came about through railroad monopolies. And the railroads were able to, because they had this brand new technology, and they could be gatekeepers in terms of getting goods to market. They had a large influence on what got over to consumers and what didn't. And so the railroad trusts were a major part of this. The telegraph as well, because communication that went cross-country had a gatekeeper as well in it. So it kind of mirrors, from a technological standpoint, anytime you have this disruptive new technology that comes into a marketplace, it offers opportunities for monopoly actors to use it and collect tolls on it and you know, concentrate that sector in major ways. So what we saw at that point, And you can even go back even further. I mean, the Boston Tea Party largely was something that was a reaction to a monopoly, the British East India Company being able to have a monopoly on the sale of tea. So Americans had this sense that big concentrated industries were a threat to liberty, that they were a threat to not just the ability for people to get a good at a fair price, but the ability on economic liberty to, if you had a certain set of skills and talents, that you could actually bring them to bear and make a living for yourself in what you wanted to do without having to be squeezed out by a large monopoly operator. So there were movements in America, particularly around the Gilded Age, when this became just really intolerable, whether it was farmers who had trouble getting their goods to market because of the railroad monopolies, or it was usually interest in, I think this started really kind of in the West, people who were skeptical of Eastern business interests. There was the progressive movement, there was the Granger movement, and eventually this, you know, fluttered up into Washington, and we got the Sherman Antitrust Act. And
what, is that what it was? I mean, a lot of like, I mean, because I'm just curious, I mean, it sounds like it, to a certain extent, a lot of this was sort of like agrarian populism on some level.
Absolutely.
Pushing back against the, because, you know, my my sense is that the railroad barons owned, to a large extent, like governors more than they did maybe federal, you know, and an occasional senator. And I think, you know, most of my knowledge of this of history at that time is pretty
well,
thin.
Well, of course, senators were chosen by the state legislature,
right?
So they were, you know, there were corrupting influences within the Senate because that came more directly from state government. The House was a more closer to the people at that time, and you know, I think what we saw, there wasn't just the Gilded Age, but you know, there were like financial crises every 4 years.
Right.
During that time, and so there, this did generate a populist movement that eventually became something that Washington couldn't ignore.
Maybe that's the biggest argument for going back on the gold standard, is that we would have those type of massive financial crises every 4 years, and we would see a little bit more of a backlash. But let's put that on hold for the time being.
Try not to do that.
So at the time that the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed, there was
unanimously, by the way, almost unanimously, the Sherman Antitrust Act.
The authors made clear that innocent monopolies, ones that didn't set out essentially to become monopolies for an advantage, but rather because they were so good at business, they created monopolies.
Right.
Were okay as long as they did not have, I guess, bad effects on the on innovation and on price competition.
Right. There was a kind of this split. And the best way to think about this split is to think about the 1912 election. The 1912 election, you had William Howard Taft was the president, and that was the Republican idea was basically laissez-faire. It was that's the faction that Taft came from anyway, that was, you know, monopolies are fine, we don't have to mess with it. Roosevelt, who was president prior, he was the Bull Moose Party in that election. They believed sort of in finding the right people to administer the monopoly, and as long as they were enlightened and this you know, they could manage it in a very studious way, that wouldn't be a problem. So it was anti-monopoly, but it was anti the wrong kind of monopoly, basically. Wilson, and particularly his chief speechwriter, Louis Brandeis, who was later a Supreme Court justice, was really motivated by a reaction against bigness. that it wasn't, there wasn't a right monopoly and a wrong monopoly, that this was a problem when you have this over-concentration. It inevitably slips into bad effects for Americans. And so, you know, Wilson won that particular election, and the Clayton Act, which was sort of the follow-up to the Sherman Act, and they created the Federal Trade Commission, which has this additional responsibility on antitrust, was created. Ultimately, that didn't go far enough because we got into World War One, and there were a lot of other factors for why the sort of Wilsonian, Brandeisian idea of antitrust didn't get fully implemented. But you know, the courts, ultimately what happened is the courts ended up sort of shaping what the Sherman Act meant. The Sherman Act was very vague. It allowed a lot of leeway for the judiciary to interpret it, and it ended up interpreting it in the manner you described. This idea of there's the possibility for innocent monopolies, the possibility of they employed a test to see whether or not this tipped into something that was disfavored, that's kind of where it ended up. And the issue is, you know, Sherman Act passes like 1890. We don't really see real enforcement of the antitrust laws until after the Great Depression. We saw some of it here and there. Standard Oil gets broken up, and you know, Roosevelt did some things, Northern Securities. But it's really after the Depression, and particularly when a man named Thurman Arnold is put in charge of the antitrust division by President Franklin Roosevelt, that we really see a strong enforcement of the antitrust laws. And supporters of antitrust like to throw out this chart that shows the unemployment rate, and it pinpoints the moment that Thurman Arnold was put in charge of the antitrust division, and that's the moment at which you see the unemployment just plummet. That's the point at which this goes down. And so, you know, Arnold was very aggressive. The golden age, so-called, of antitrust is between the 30s and late 1970s, early 1980s. When you see enforcement, even if a company or the byproduct of a merger would lead to 5% or 8% market share within a particular sector, even those would be challenged in the 1950s. You know, there were cases where even if it was an innocent monopoly, as you said, even those not only would be challenged, but would be successfully challenged in court. That even if it was a monopoly that was by no other means than, you know, good stewardship of the particular business, that would still need to be broken.
And during this era, what is the remedy? I mean, when this is the golden era, and you have more stringent enforcement, what is the remedy?
The remedy is often that they would block the merger. There were divestitures. There were breakups of various industries. The most famous didn't come till later. That was the Bell telephone breakup.
Remember. I mean, I remember when it was all just, it was one company. Right. And then all of a sudden we all had these sort of regional...
Southwestern Bell. And then they all reformed like a transformer into AT&T. There were a lot of countervailing forces too. There were things called conglomerates that, if you couldn't own 60% of one industry, you would own 20% of one industry. And then in addition to selling baked beans, you would make hats. You know,
right.
There was that ITT was like this huge conglomerate of that day. And there were a lot of others, and that was sort of business's workaround. to grow while not, you know, running afoul of the monopoly, anti-monopoly laws.
All right, so we have this golden era of antitrust, and then a guy who was famous for not becoming a Supreme Court justice, Robert Bork, back when I guess he was a was he just a professor or
I mean professor? Yeah, he was a former Solicitor General, but I think that came later. He might have been under Nixon, but he was a professor at Yale, and he was strongly associated with the University of Chicago, kind of Milton Friedman economic movement, and he wrote this book called The Antitrust Paradox. And in it, and that book and the ideas in that book are completely responsible for the shift in antitrust policy and jurisprudence that we see today. I mean, and 100%.
And it's stunning because it's basically, he just creates a myth, essentially.
Right?
I mean, that's basically what it is. It's like, it's as if he wrote a, with all due respect to those people who think that the Bible is the word of God. He creates a story, basically.
Right.
And then you have all these acolytes who decide this is the story we're going to believe in. And this one explains everything. There's no data to support it. There's no, you know, I mean, I guess they had models that would support it, but the actual data does not exist. And that's basically this notion that the only reason why the monopolies in and of themselves are not bad, it's just that the Sherman Act is basically just to protect consumer welfare, and you could actually sort of project out and assume that a monopoly is going to help consumers just as easily as you could not help them.
Absolutely. I mean, he brought this into a very economic realm. And once you put it in the hands of economics, you can certainly find any number of economists willing to say, well, this will create efficiencies if you, you know, there's economies of scale, if you have a more concentrated sector, and those benefits will go on to consumers. And it was not a theory in Bork's mind. It was what happens. I mean, this was just absolute, and as you say, it's there actually is no evidence for it. There's a guy out of Northeastern University named John Cuoca who did this large retrospective study looking back at mergers over I think it was a 30-year period, and looking at the change in prices since. To Bork, it was all about prices. So he took Bork on his own terms, kind of. And he said, okay, let's look at these mergers retrospectively and see what the change in prices was. And all the prices went up. I mean, virtually all of them. I think it was 38 out of 46 studies. And they went up more when there were these sort of conditions-based remedies, these things. This became in the vogue in the post-Golden Age era. That okay, if you come up with some conditions that will, you know, make sure that we don't have a fully concentrated sector, whether it's a divestiture or some other promotion of competition, then that would be okay. This is what the antitrust division said, the FTC said, and basically what Cuoca found is when there were conditions placed, it got even worse. That if it was 8%. Increase in prices for a normal merger. If in a conditions-based merger, it would be a 16% increase in price.
So, in other words, even if you strip out all the other reasons why you don't want a monopoly, right, which is that market concentration, it stifles innovation, it makes it harder for other people to enter into a certain industry.
It hurts wages,
and it also concentrates power that could ultimately end up as political power.
Correct.
Even if you eliminate all of that and just take it based upon the very narrow construct that Bork had said, that in and of itself was a fiction, that the entire Reagan administration, it seems like, operated under either knowingly or unknowingly that it was a fiction.
Not just the entire Reagan administration, but the entire judiciary. And what the Reagan administration did is change the guidelines in the Justice Department, the guidelines for which they would actually challenge a merger or challenge an industry that was more concentrated than it needed to be. So once they did that, it wasn't really just that impact, but Bork's writing had a strong impact on the judiciary. And, of course, in the 1980s, through the 12 years of Republican rule, a lot of Federalist Society, hardcore conservatives, even if Bork didn't get on the Supreme Court, a lot of Bork acolytes got
right
into federal courts all over the country. And they implemented Bork's ideas on this. And it became something that antitrust battles became battles between competing pairs of economists. And you had to come up with all this data, and there were models, and there were charts, and it stopped being a political issue at that point. It became an issue of, well, if you can see the consumer welfare on this scale that we created, if it tips in one direction, then we're going to allow the merger. If it tips in another direction, we're not going to allow the merger. And it became much more and more stringent on the part, became much more difficult.
So, in other words,
the Justice Department to actually act.
It didn't actually stop becoming a political issue. It presumed to be a question of like a technocratic question, as opposed to decision.
It shifted the terrain,
and
it stopped being talked about. Even though, I mean, the great irony, and I put this in the story, is that when we talk about breaking up the banks, we're talking about antitrust. When we
right
talk about net neutrality, we're talking about antitrust. When we talk about the high cost of health care and the high cost of prescription drugs, we're talking about antitrust. But we don't talk about it that way, and there is no real movement, a consumer-based or an activist-based movement, saying that the problems we're having is that we're being disempowered by this extreme monopolization, which has economic feedbacks and political feedbacks.
We should also say that when the Reagan administration did that, you write about the implications of, you had a huge rash of mergers, which was driven largely by Wall Street, because there was huge fees to be farmed and mined there.
I have a great anecdote that came out after the piece. We just recently.
Well, wait a second. Let me do this then.
What's that? Breaking news?
I got to do the breaking news.
I don't know how breaking it is. But,
all right. Well, okay.
So, Anheuser-Busch InBev and SAB Miller, which were already two of these huge beer conglomerates, they merged, or they've proposed to merge. And there was a story in the New York Times showing that they proposed to merge. And the last two paragraphs of the story names all of the law firms and Wall Street banks that were involved in the merger. And I counted them out. There were 18 of them.
Wow.
And all of them took a fee for that. More recently, in the Allergan Pfizer merger proposal, I believe it's $350 million in fees that were generated just off of that. There's been $4 trillion in merger and acquisition activity this year. And you can see why Wall Street would be really thrilled for no more enforcement of the antitrust laws, because it means huge profits for them.
All right. So without getting too deep into it, we obviously see a lot of this in the context of the Internet, of businesses that we perceive on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon is using their strength as a buyer. And we've talked about monopsony in the context of labor, where you have buyers essentially for labor, and why things like the minimum wage doesn't necessarily affect job losses in situations where you have some measure of monopsony. But we've seen things like Amazon basically saying to different publishers, like, you're either going to take a reduction in the fee that you get for making the book and for paying the writer, and the writer's going to take a reduction in fee, or we're not going to sell them. And if we don't sell your books, in this day and age, we've cornered the market. We're basically the country's bookstore, period. And we're going to, you know, you can go and sell it at Powell's, you know, but, you know, most people come to Amazon. That's just because they know us more. And we're also seeing this in the context of Facebook is about to make a big move where they basically, you got to put stuff natively on Facebook. In other words, it's got to start there or people will
News articles.
I'm talking about news articles and videos and whatever. It's going to be anything that is on the web that people put up on their own sites that you put up at David Day and Tumblr or whatnot. Or frankly, at the American Prospect, nobody's going to see it if you don't put it directly on Facebook. So we have that
what
problem.
We're seeing, it's a return to walled gardens, which is what they called the internet, or at least how the internet was described, you know, back in the days of America Online and CompuServe. If the internet was going to America Online and seeing what they had to offer. And that's what we're getting back to with things like Facebook. And Amazon, and you know, a handful of other companies, and Apple to an extent, in music and video generation. So, I mean, this is just an extension of the Walmart problem. That Walmart has the ability to squeeze their suppliers because they have a large monopoly, and if you want your product in front of customers, you have to get it in the Walmart. And this is just a digital equivalent of that. This is just, you know, it's an extension. And yet, monopsony, which is sort of the flip side of monopoly, it's not monopolies for consumers, but monopolies on producers. And that has just as damaging effects. I mean, we like the fact that we can go to Amazon and it's the world's largest bookstore, and we can get a copy of a book for $5, but we don't think about the fact that the person who's writing it and the publishing company who produced it is not getting paid at the same level as they would if it was a normal situation.
Now,
the
big case I remember where I think monopsony came into play was the Microsoft case, right, where Microsoft was saying, you can have our operating system to all of these PCs. You can have our operating system. You can have Windows. However, you got to take all this other crap that we're going to give you, and you got to put it on your computers, right? I mean,
right.
And
there are similar suits or proposed suits or investigations of Google in that respect to what they do with the Android operating system and what they do with their search engine that prefers their native products over competitors.
So where is the Obama administration been? How would you grade them? I mean, are we seeing any uptick in this type of antitrust enforcement? I mean, there's been some major mergers, I think, that have basically been quashed, which is good. And part of that seems to me to be coming from some voices in the Senate as well. Where has the Obama administration been, and where do you think we're going with this, if anywhere?
Right. It's a big question to answer. I think the general belief is that this has been mixed, that they came in with a lot of big talk. There's a theory that I know Barry Lynn, who's a great resource on all of this antitrust monopoly stuff. His theory is that Obama won the presidency because of antitrust, because in Iowa, he talked heavily about the problems on food producers with dealing with agribusiness and these large monopoly chains and how they were being treated unfairly in getting their goods out, and that won him Iowa and subsequently won him the election. So they took it seriously, at least for the first year or two. There were a series of field hearings that were held around the country about that very issue, about farming and monopolies. They withdrew some really bad opinions by the Bush Justice Department that were on antitrust. But when push came to shove, when you looked at the actual things that were happening, they retreated to using a lot of conditions-based remedies, which, as I said, are even worse than no remedy at all. They let a lot of these things pass. And in more recent years, the way someone put it to me is that the only reason we're seeing some pushback now, whether it's the Comcast-Time Warner merger or the AT&T-T-Mobile merger, those kind of things being squashed, is that it's so concentrated now that you almost can't, you couldn't possibly wave your head and walk away from some of these merger deals that are being done. There was a study, John Cuoco actually also did this other study, where he looked at what happens when various industries get concentrated, and say from six competitors, major competitors, to five competitors, or five to four to three, three to two, whatever. So the Obama administration, and this I think was only went through the first term, but the Obama administration, when it got down to four to three or worse, they generally challenged. The antitrust division or the FTC generally challenged those mergers. When it was above that line, they almost never challenged. When it was seven to six or six to five, things like that, they almost never challenged the mergers. So it was those mid-level concentrations that they kind of neglected, and that allowed a significant amount of concentration to enter in, and then, you know, you're just desperately trying to stave off the last bit of competition. That's kind of where they took their last stand. But it was a wide difference from how antitrust was enforced in the Golden Age, when, you know, if there was a merger that created a business with 10% of the market, they would challenge it.
Interesting.
So it's a big, big difference. And so that leads us to the question of where we go now, where we go today.
Do you see something like this as being, I mean, this seems to me to fall right into a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren portfolio. I mean, are we going to see more of this? And I would say even, you know, we've seen it at least with Al Franken in the context of the Universal Comcast, NBC Comcast merger.
Yeah. This is actually sort of a problem, is that Franken talks about it in terms of the cable companies.
Right.
And Elizabeth Warren talks about it in terms of the banks.
Right.
And, you know, nobody gets together and says this is an antitrust issue. It's still sort of walled off into these various sectors, and no one sees the bigger picture. This is something that's...
Do they not see the bigger picture, or is it because there's a lot of medical mouth manufacturers in Minnesota?
That's certainly part of it, okay. In Massachusetts. You know, it's a good question, and there is nobody right now on the national level that is connecting these dots and saying that you know, this is why you have economic anxiety. This is why you feel disempowered by this economy and this government. This is why big business has such power in politics. This is why it seems like every year our wages are stagnating, our services get worse and worse, the price of various basic needs like health care go up and up. Point to this. You know, I mean, this is what Zephyr Teachout decided to do in her campaign. She tells me this story about how when she was asked initially to run for governor of New York, she said, I want to talk about this. And the Working Families Party pulled this issue, and it didn't really register with people.
Right.
Probably because nobody
talked
even
talking about it.
And she said, well, I want to do it anyway. And she held campaign events at Comcast, you know, cable offices, and she talked about these issues in a lot of detail. And what she found was that once you cut through this with people, they get it, whether it's farmers in upstate New York or people who are struggling to pay their bills in New York City or the surrounding area. People did get it. And it was interesting that, as you know, in that election, the counties where Teach Out did very well were upstate.
Yep.
And that's, you know, the dairy farm counties where they get this issue because there is so much concentration in food production. And the suppliers, which, and that's who they are, if you're talking about upstate New York, are being squeezed in tremendous ways. And so that showed, I think that campaign showed that there's a model for this. And, you know, to her credit, Hillary Clinton has been talking about this. I think the spectacle of who's the guy, the pharma bro, Martin Shkreli, is, you know, the guy from Turing Pharmaceuticals who jacked up the price 5,000% of a life-saving drug,
right.
The Valeant scandal, this Pfizer merger. You're starting to see it in terms of healthcare and pharmaceuticals, and maybe that's where it begins. But Hillary Clinton has been talking about the need for stronger antitrust laws, usually around the healthcare issue. Bernie has been talking about it in kind of an elliptical way. In his speech at Georgetown, he mentioned monopolies. So there's a possibility there, but I think we need to see it on more of a grassroots level. To the extent, and Zephyr Teachout told me this, to the extent that the Obama administration was disappointing on antitrust, part of that is on us.
Right.
That there wasn't really a movement to force the administration to take a stronger enforcement stand. And so that became an easy promise to break.
Indeed.
And so what is needed is an antitrust movement, a bottom-up understanding of these issues, which affect all of us every single day, every time we go into any store, any time we try to buy anything. There needs to be an awareness of how that is affecting us as consumers, as workers, and as citizens. And only then will you put politicians in a position to actually listen to these concerns.
David Dayan, the piece is Bring Back Antitrust. It's at the American Prospect. We will put a link to it. Of course, always a pleasure to talk to you. And thanks so much for this, David. Really fascinating
stuff. Well, thanks so much for letting me go into such detail about it. I appreciate it.
No, it's great stuff. And I'm glad you're writing about it because it's one of those, I think, big issues that I hope we see more about, at least in terms of the overall perspective on it, rather than sort of just nibbling at different edges of the elephant, as it were. All right, David, thanks so much.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. I don't know how much more I've got in me to continue on, but I will do my best. Don't forget that you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm, or you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Like we said earlier in the program, Sheldon Silver was a huge supporter of this program through various sock puppet accounts. As soon as he was indicted, of course, a lot of those got shut down, and we lost many cedar. What is going on? Are they vacuuming out there?
They're vacuuming out there.
This is a weird day for them to vacuum on Tuesday at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, and we actually talked about it a couple of months ago, and he was like, yeah, no problem. We'll always do it, too. So I don't know. Maybe it's a different dude.
Maybe it's a different schedule. We're going to have to talk to that guy. But
can I just say about Sheldon Silver, I'm not saying anything, but it may or may not be a coincidence that we haven't heard from Bush and Chains in a while.
That is weird. That is very weird.
Yeah.
When we take the IMs and the fun half of the program, soon as Sheldon Silver.
Yeah.
Oh, that is fascinating.
That's the thing. Wouldn't that be great? He'd be like, okay, I got an asbestos scam to run, and then a pro-Israel luncheon, and then I'm going to hire Sam.
I've got to be completely available from 12 to 1, 12 to 2 every day, so I can IM Sam on the app.
Anti-Zionist vitriol and Rastafarian links. It's how I unwind.
It's like a big CEO who goes to a dominatrix.
Exactly.
Right? Like, you
except
need
he's
to
like
yourself...
self-dominatrixing
That's
himself.
Right. There's no doubt in my mind. I'm quite convinced that Bush and Chains, either Sheldon Silver or maybe Dershowitz.
Yeah. I think if it was Dershowitz, there would be more disturbing stuff frankly. Right. I think Bush and Chains is too tame.
It's also possible that you don't need to get all of this stuff out of your system with just one show.
True.
Right? You could be creating a sock puppet. So if you're like a Dershowitz, you write into this show to espouse a certain anti-Zionism.
Right.
But then maybe you write into other shows to sort of get other things off your chest,
like,
too.
I respect woman, psych.
Right. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, who knows?
What I think we all know who Doug is.
Who Doug is?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty obvious.
Let's see. Well, Doug's big ballywick is immigration.
So yeah, but just...
Are you suggesting that maybe Doug is like, is maybe some big pro-immigration activist?
I may or may not be hinting at something like that.
Who is that New York Times reporter who was undocumented?
Oh.
Do we remember who that was?
The Filipino gentleman. I actually forget his name. I also, because I know him more as Doug.
There you go.
Yeah.
folks.
He also could be Joe Lieberman. Just throwing it out there.
Not only does Harry's.com make for a great Hanukkah or Christmas gift, but so too does JustCoffee.coop. And actually, I'll tell you something. You could do a lot worse for a stocking stuffer than to give someone a razor and a coffee. Because then you're hitting both sort of like, I mean, the best gifts are ones that people use every single day. Every single day they use this gift. JustCoffee.coop. Wow, you really shut them down.
Oh, I can't control who talks to him on his walkie-talkie.
Oh, is that what's going on?
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually did tell him, though. I said, frankly, this guy is a total pain in the ass. And the more noise you can make, the better. He's sick.
So
just push down his immune system a little more.
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. It makes a great gift. And it's also, I've gotten multiple emails from people who said, like, I turned my conservative uncle onto Just Coffee and the Majority Report blend. They have no idea that they're supporting your show every time they buy this coffee now. Using the coupon code. So that's like a quadruple win. And of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, if you already buy your stuff from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majoritycreditreport.com. All right, quick break. Come back with the fun half of the program.